From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have seen U.S. military women move ever deeper into combat zones and roles. Early this year, the Pentagon outlined new steps toward formal combat roles for women. This month, female soldiers, Army, began moving into jobs in once all-male units. This hour On Point for Memorial Day, we're looking at women and combat roles in the U.S. military. We'll turn in a few minutes to a conversation we first had in February when the changes were announced. We'll go first to an Army captain, Ashley Russell, just back from Afghanistan, who I talked with last week. We aren't taking calls this hour, but you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Colorado Springs is Army Captain Ashley Russell. In 2009, she served a tour in Iraq. A few days ago, Captain Russell returned from a 12-month tour in Afghanistan, Kandahar. She's the sister of one of our producers at On Point, so has our special attention. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, she's seen plenty of combat zone. Captain Ashley Russell, welcome to On Point, and welcome home, Captain.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
How is it to be back stateside?
It's great.
What's the first thing you did?
Well, my parents and one of my best friends came and visited me, or they met me off the plane, I guess. So that was nice. That was the first thing that I did.
That's got to be great. A year is a long time, and in Kandahar, it can be kind of a hot scene there. What was your deployment? What was your role there, Captain Russell?
Well, I had two jobs. My primary job was to be kind of the political advisor for my brigade commander, and then my secondary job was to manage all the female engagement teams that we had in our brigade. We had about 15 teams.
So that means you'd be part of the time, presumably, at the base with the brigade commander and part of the time in the field?
Yes.
How often were you out in, I don't know, what might be called a combat zone?
I left the wire about 3 to 5 times a week.
And this would be in the company of whom to do what?
It depends on what I was doing, but for the brigade commander, he would go out and meet for key leader engagements. So I would go with him to every engagement, and then some of the time I would go out, and I would go out with my female engagement teams. I went out with each one of them at least once during the 12 months.
The female engagement team, what does that do, Ashley?
Well, it's about 2 to 3 women, depending on how many women we could get to do it. But 2 to 3 women, they go out and they basically interface with the female population of Afghanistan. So they establish rapport with them, kind of try and give those women a voice that they haven't been able to.
And
they
when you
been able to share.
When you were out doing that, would you be traveling with other soldiers? Would you be with a combat unit that was traveling around the Kandahar area?
Yes. How it works is each team is attached to a maneuver company, so either an infantry or an armor company. And in one case, we had an engineer element that we had two women attached to.
So you'd be sitting down with that unit with you or around, talking with Afghan women there in Kandahar. When people in the States think about combat zones in Iraq or, in this case, Afghanistan, I mean, I guess we all know at this point there are not clear lines, but what about the issue of combat and just traveling around to do that work, that business?
Well, I mean, everybody is kind of doing a similar job in that aspect. We're all, I mean, for example, if we were in the city, we would all leave the base and it would be dismounted and we would all move as a group, either a squad or two squads. And so it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, you're still doing the same kind of thing. You're still doing the same kind of job, and you're still in the same amount of danger.
What were the dangers? What were the threats as you were pursuing that work?
Depending on where we were, and just to kind of give you a background of how our brigade was laid out, mm-hmm. We were in Kandahar, but we had 5 different districts, and the northernmost districts were more mountainous and rural, and we also had Kandahar City, like the proper city. So it was a city, and it was mm-hmm. We were able to walk a lot more there.
I know, I think
oh,
I understand. You had mortar attacks on your base itself, so even at the base or behind
right.
the wire, inside the wire, you've got that threat. But when you were out, Was this IED territory? What kind of threat was there when you were doing your work?
In the city, it was more small arms fire, and then some IEDs, some vehicle-borne IEDs. And then up north, it was more, there were more IED threats than small arms fire. But you get both everywhere, and then, of course, mortar attacks.
So when you hear this conversation about whether or not U.S. military service women ought to be in combat zones and combat roles, what are you thinking as you hear that?
Honestly, it's kind of laughable, if I'm being completely honest, because we've been doing that job. Women have been in that role for some time now. So it's not really any different. It's just different on paper.
Were there women who were looking to do things that they couldn't do, even with that, because of the formal restrictions that have been there in the military?
I guess so, yes. Women cannot technically be certain branches. They can't be armor, infantry. But there's really no... I don't think that there's any true restriction on if they can go out with certain people, if they can go outside the wire with certain elements or anything like that. So, no, not really.
The rules that have come out and that we're reading about this week, we're going to talk about, we'll talk more about the anticipation of them in a moment, but they're talking about new jobs within combat battalions in personnel, intelligence, logistics, signal corps, medical and chaplaincy, also jobs at once entirely closed to women, mechanics for tanks, artillery and rocket launcher crew members. Is it a big topic of conversation in the U.S. Army in Kandahar, what women are doing or will be doing? Is it something that troops are talking about, Captain Russell?
I did not hear a whole lot of talk about it within our battalion, or our brigade, I'm sorry. Our brigade is actually one of the, the test beds for the women going into combat arms battalions. So that's something that is changing within our brigade specifically, and that was addressed, but very briefly, and nobody really said anything about it. Nobody had a problem with it, and nobody really voiced any opinion on it, to be honest.
Do you foresee a time when women are right there on patrol with male soldiers, rifle in hand, full kit, going straight into what is anticipated to be a firefight? Or would these new rules already make that a likelihood or certainty?
That's actually already happening, so I don't think that it will change much.
It's already happening by design, or because it just happens?
Because
firefights show up.
They just happen, yeah.
How do you think we're doing in Afghanistan? What about in your area, Kandahar?
I definitely, from the start of our deployment to the end of our deployment, I definitely saw a lot of progress. With the government, with the Afghan government, and the security. Obviously, some areas are more apt to be more progressive than others, but I would say as a whole, it's definitely getting better security-wise and politically.
That was in your area of Afghanistan, around Kandahar. You witnessed. What about the big problems that are still out there in Afghanistan?
I don't know if I can really speak to that, because I haven't really seen it.
I mean, we all hear about corruption. We all hear about narco trafficking. We all hear about the continuing presence of the Taliban. You must have seen evidence of some of those things if you're out and about in Kandahar, Afghanistan.
Absolutely. That was actually what I was meant to focus on for the brigade commander. We certainly did see that, but there's a much lesser presence of corruption, specifically corruption, and then ties to Taliban. And I think the thing that we wanted to focus mostly on was any ties to corruption and any Taliban ties within the government, because that is one of the bigger complaints from the locals, that they might not necessarily trust their government or their security forces because they're corrupt. And we definitely saw a little bit of it, but it improved drastically while we were there.
Do you have a sense of the U.S. military, male or female, anticipating the exit that's getting so much attention now? I mean, back on this side, it's all about getting out. Is that the mood among the troops there, male, female, you name it?
No, not really. I think we're transitioning more towards a Afghan security forces in the lead, but I don't really see American forces basically throwing up their hands and being like, okay, it's time to leave. It's more like we're preparing them to take control of their area, and we're preparing them as best as we can. And they're definitely doing a good job. They're definitely putting themselves in the lead.
And finally, do you think it'll be a different military when women are formalized in more combat roles? Will it be a changed military, or have we already made the change in the decade of these conflicts?
I think the nature of these conflicts kind of lend itself to a change anyway. So to change it formally I don't think it really does too much.
That's where we are right now. Captain Russell, welcome home from Afghanistan.
Thank you.
That was Army Captain Ashley Russell, just back from a year-long tour in Afghanistan. After the break, we'll listen back to our conversation from February about women on the front lines. At the time of our show, the Pentagon had just announced the changes that would formally endorse the changes that were already happening. Women in the U.S. military moving much closer to combat. We'll hear from Margaret Harrell, Senior Fellow and Director of the Joining Forces Initiative at the Center for New American Security. Kayla Williams, who served as an Army Sergeant in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. She was an interpreter and is author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And we'll be joined by retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about women and combat in the U.S. military. New rules are acknowledging what's already been happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. Women have often been in the thick of it. We're asking how far this should, will go this hour. Here's a female engagement team of 19 women deploying with the South Carolina Army National Guard to Afghanistan for the first time this year. The mission, to gain the trust of local women there, Sergeant Scarlett Martinez speaks.
Sometimes the men, they see us as, you know, why are the females part of the infantry now? But for them, they're starting to realize that we're an asset to them.
An asset to them. Major Sergeant Rick Turner with the South Carolina Army National Guard speaks here.
The truth is the truth. American females are on the front lines. The American populace know this. They're on the front lines and they're doing the same thing and fighting the same war equally as their American male soldier.
And have been for some years now in Iraq and Afghanistan in many, many circumstances. We're going to dive in and look at this today. Joining us from Washington, first, Margaret Harrell, Senior Fellow and Director of the Joining Forces Initiative at the Center for New American Security. She's looked closely at the role of women in the military. Margaret, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And from Washington, Kayla Williams is with us, sergeant in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. She served as an Arabic interpreter. She's author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. Kayla Williams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Margaret Harrell, first to you. What's being acknowledged in these new steps being taken by the U.S. military?
Well, I think the main thing that's being acknowledged is that the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is very different from any situation in which we fought before. A lot of our policies about where military women could serve were based on the presumption that there were safe areas and not safe areas, and that's just not the case in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Kayla Williams, what was your experience in Iraq when it came to lines, you know, front lines, back lines, and lines of function, like, you know, women carrying the rifle and using it?
I took part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003 and went out on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad. I had no plates in my flak vest because they assumed that as a female, I wouldn't need them. But when it came right down to it, what they needed was somebody who could communicate between U.S. soldiers and the local people. So I went out, I did my job, and I did it well. I believe any of the infantrymen that I walked alongside would have rather had me there with them, female or not, than to not have an interpreter at all. And for the rest of my time that I was there, I spent time with every unit in our division, got tossed around all over the place, was often very forward deployed. And during combat operations, my gender was never an issue, only the skills that I brought to the table.
No plates in your flak vest, meaning no armored plates in there. I don't understand that. If you're on foot patrol along with patrols going out into rough situations, does that say that they were somehow keeping you at the rear of their patrols?
No.
How could you have no plates?
What it says is, you may recall the phrase, you go to war with the army you have.
Yeah.
And I got them later, but during the initial invasion, they did not... they did not issue them to me.
Were there restrictions on your activity in that on those foot patrols? Were you just there to translate? Were you a trigger puller?
Everyone is a soldier first. If we had come under fire, I absolutely would have been called upon to return fire just as much as anyone else. We've had females die in combat already, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been one female awarded the Silver Star for her valor in combat in Iraq and another in Afghanistan. So clearly women are expected to do their duties as soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, just like their male counterparts.
Margaret Harrell, Kayla Williams, as a sergeant in Iraq, was an interpreter there. What other kinds of roles have brought women into combat situations in this last decade, Margaret?
Well, what's very interesting is a lot of the occupations that have more of our women proportionately are occupations that in previous wars we would have thought were further back from the front. So a lot of the support, the logistics, the supply, the fuel handlers, there's a lot of women in those positions. And the reality is in Iraq and Afghanistan, these types of forces are right up with all the other forces. They're all intermixed.
But, I mean, I'm just trying to get a picture. For those of us who haven't been out there, we see some of these forward bases in Afghanistan, you know, way up on the side of a mountain in the middle of nowhere. In footage I've seen of that, I haven't typically seen women there. When is there still sex segregation?
Well, there's really not a lot of sex segregation because if you think about those forward operating bases, logistics have to get to them. And when the supply convoys come, there's women in those supply convoys. And that's how we've had a lot of women come under fire and have engagements with the enemy. And that's why we have a lot of women, for example, that have earned the combat action badge.
Back in 2003, I spent 6 weeks on the side of a mountain at a listening post observation post with about seven male troops, and then another few months on the other side of the same mountain with about 20 male troops. So I was at one of those very remote outposts, and there was no difference in the circumstances I lived in than those of the men that I served alongside.
Margaret, Kayla, the sister of one of my producers here at On Point is an Army captain deployed in Afghanistan, and when we were talking with her about this via email, and she said, you know, I mean, the current policy just seems obsolete. She wrote to us that they're, you know, making a big deal about women serving in ground combat units is almost a little insulting, she said. It discredits those of us who've been doing it all along. She said, as a woman who's been in combat and led others into combat, I do not think women should be restricted from any position for which they're mentally, emotionally, and physically qualified. She writes, lifting the ban on women in ground combat should ensure a more gender-neutral policy, hopefully allowing a more capable military. Is that where we're headed, Margaret?
Well, we're partway there. Andrew Tillman spoke about the co-location restriction that's been lifted, and that did open about 13,000 of the positions that are newly open to women. But the other change that's been enacted is an exemption to the policy that previously had kept women from being assigned to combat arms units at the battalion level. And now that has been exempted in the Army for nine brigade combat teams. Women can be formally assigned to the battalions within those combat units. So we're partway there now.
Kayla, do you see the remaining restrictions on American women's combat roles in the military as a career problem for women who devote their careers to the military? Does it put a sort of a brass ceiling, I've seen it called, on women's careers?
Yes, I definitely think that that can be part of the problem. Another aspect to the issue, in my opinion, is that by preventing women from serving in combat arms jobs, by keeping us out of the infantry, it institutionalizes a perception that we are second-class soldiers. And I believe that encourages tacitly sexual harassment by portraying us as not real soldiers in every situation.
That's interesting. We'll look at that aspect. Margaret, is this ultimately, though, is it really about equal opportunity in a career sense, or is it about U.S. military capacity in combat?
Well, I think it's about U.S. military capability and giving our military commanders the most flexibility they can have as to how best to use their people. And as we head to a force that's going to be downsized, the challenges of a downsized force will require greater flexibility, being able to use the people that you have, the best way that you can to their greatest capability.
What about those, Kayla, who say there are physical differences between men and women, and so, you know, just size-wise, let's say, and so let's not take this line down. It's important.
There are physical differences between genders, but also within genders and between different age groups. If there are certain jobs or certain theaters of operation in which there are very stringent physical requirements, I support applying those across the board. If there is a male who is too weak or due to his age or size or whatever else to perform certain skills, then he too should be banned from that job or that theater. But if a woman is physically capable, there's no reason that she shouldn't be out there. You heard earlier from somebody who's about to deploy as a member of a female engagement team, one of the callers that you had. And we are already out there because we can provide very special skills. We can be an asset, especially in counterinsurgency operations in Muslim countries, where our ability to communicate with the female half of the population is absolutely vital. Women are already out there carrying the same weight, walking alongside men in those mountains. We're proving every day that we can do it.
There's tradition leaning against it. There's fact and reality now in Iraq encompassing it, it sounds like, in many days, in many places. There's a death toll. 144 female troops have died in those wars, 865 wounded, which tells us something in itself. Margaret Harrell, Kayla Williams, please stand by in Washington. I want to bring Robert McGinnis into our conversation, retired from the Army as lieutenant colonel in 93. He was a senior strategist in the U.S. Army. He's now a senior fellow for national security at the Family Research Council, conservative Christian group, lobbies on all kinds of fronts. He's a columnist for Human Events, a conservative news site. Robert McGinnis, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
You must have seen what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, women stepping up into all kinds of roles in those theaters. Now, there's some moving of the boundaries just last week that will formalize some of those changes and bring them within the ambit of military rules. Should this go further, Robert? If women are picking up the gun and putting on the muscle and going out into combat, should we take down the formal restrictions?
I don't think so, Tom. No, I appreciate the civil discussion and certainly the issues of, you know, women being engaged and wounded and killed and being heroic on the battlefield. There's no question about what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, my concern is, where does this lead? As Margaret indicated, there's been incrementalism, and I've been around the Army for more than four decades, and I'm seeing that incrementalism. Some, I think, has been very good. The next step, though, I'm very concerned about. As an infantryman, a ranger, and I've been in Iraq a couple of times, and I follow this very closely, I'm very concerned that ultimately we are going to dismiss the real issues that discriminate between men and women in this type of environment. And that environment, by the way, is changing again. And ultimately, I believe that we will end up with conscription. I do believe that our young women in a future time will be conscripted for combat. And I don't think we need to go that far. Yes, young women are contributing greatly. They are in the mix this day. And probably until Afghanistan is over, we'll continue to have that. But as the president said in announcing his new strategy last month, you know, stability ops, counterinsurgencies, that's something we're not going to be really engaged in the future. We will have counterterrorism activities. We're going back to more conventional type of battle. So, you know, do we adapt to the current battle or do we adapt to the future battle if, in fact, the president's strategy is correct?
Robert McGinnis, what are the real issues that you say you fear would be dismissed around this subject?
If, in fact, we were to treat young women just like young men in regard to the future in a combat arena, then we have to consider the physical issue, you know, the cardiovascular, the upper body's fitness, you know, what you see on TV is not an anomaly. You know, you see these young troops carrying 80-pound packs in the mountains of Afghanistan day in and day out, and then they go into spurts of extreme violence, and they have to demonstrate considerable physical capability. And keep in mind, we always govern by categories of people, and we don't govern by individuals that happen to excel. Now, the other nations, like Canada, they went through of an interesting experiment as a direct result of what their human rights tribunal dictated. And they recruited a bunch of women, put them through infantry training, and one graduated. They do have women in combat units today, and the data is very, very slim on how they are performing in the, as infantrymen. And that's something that I would hope that any future commission would look like. But then there's also the issue, certainly, of mixing the genders. I heard what one of your guests said. I certainly have seen this firsthand. And my concern...
Seen what?
The sexual tension issues. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody heard about Rick Santorum's statement the other day, you know, that basically said that there is some sort of hardwiring in men to protect young women. Well, there's some of that, but there's also the sexual tension and what that does in forced intimate situations. I don't think we should dismiss the fact that young people bring their libidos with them into the battlefield, and that becomes a factor that we have to seriously consider, especially if you look at the evidence with regard to, you know, we do pass out contraceptives in the battlefield because we do know people engage in sex, and that leads to not only pregnancies, but it also leads to jealousies and morale issues, things that are the local commander, whether they be a platoon leader, a squad leader, or a division commander, are concerned about.
And Robert McGinnis, stand by for one moment, if you would. We've got a couple big things on the table. Let me take them to Margaret and Kayla. Margaret Harrell, first to you. Let's go first to the physical issue, just strength, 80-pound packs, humping them around the mountains of Afghanistan, and then bouts of extreme violence. Should that in and of itself put women out of that arena?
To date, women in Iraq and Afghanistan are performing just as well as their male peers. All reports back from commanders that we hear say that there's really not a problem.
But are they being asked to do the same things, carry those same 80-100-pound packs, participate in those same firefights?
They are being asked to do the same things, as they should. They're carrying their own load and their own weight.
Kayla, what's your experience on that front? I mean, if it really comes down to it, full members of combat units, does the physical issue create a barrier?
Again, if there are physical requirements, they should be applied across the board. So if you have to be able to carry an 80-pound pack 10 miles, then every male who goes into that unit should also have to pass that same test before deploying. The Army is in the middle of developing a combat readiness test. It involves hurdles, a high crawl, a casualty drag, several other tests. Everyone who deploys should be held to the same standard on that, because it doesn't matter if you're a supply sergeant. If your vehicle gets hit, you need to be able to return fire and drag an injured person out of the Humvee to a safe zone if that is necessary. So are there men who can't do it? Absolutely. Keep them out of the truck, too.
Robert McGinnis, we just have a minute before the break, but Margaret and Kayla is saying, you know, A, women are doing it already, and B, let's decide it by individual physical capacity.
Well, I certainly believe that if women were put in that position, they would have to. I have no evidence that women are carrying 80-pound backs in Afghanistan. Never seen it, and I've spent a lot of time following this issue. Give me the data. I'd like to see it. I can tell you that the Canadians tried it, and one out of 26 that went through that special training only passed. There may be one out there, but, you know, to manage a 1.5 million person organization by individuals rather than categories is very difficult.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about women and combat in the U.S. military. New rules are acknowledging what's already happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. Women have often been in the thick of it, and we're asking today how far this should, will go. Robert McGinnis is with us, retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel, senior strategist in the U.S. Army. He's now columnist for Human Events and senior fellow for national security at the Family Research Council. Margaret Harrell is with us, senior fellow, director of the Joining Forces Initiative at the Center for New American Security. And Kayla Williams is with us, a sergeant in Iraq for the invasion there 2003-2004, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. Rick Santorum talking about women and men and combat, saying there were emotional issues. He came back later to say there were men's emotional issues, not women's.
Men who are, you know, who are certainly in our culture are, you know, in, are focused on if a woman is in trouble, obviously to react, to try to protect and care for that person. That's something that is built in culturally. It's built in, and so my concern is that a being in combat in that situation, instead of focused on the mission, they may be more concerned about protecting someone who may be in a vulnerable position, a woman in a vulnerable position.
Rick Santorum thinking about emotional complications on the field of combat. Let's go to our listeners. Bourne, Massachusetts, Jack is calling. Jack, thanks, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Just, you know, as a dad of three kids that currently serve, I have a daughter that's a Marine Corps captain, two tours in Fallujah and one in Afghanistan. She was one of the original FET team commanders. She trained 50 Marines, you know, to go over to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It was about a 6 month training thing. She did the whole training, you know, everything from, you know, where they did learning Pushtun, you know, local culture.
Yes.
You know, they all had to be, what she basically did was train them so they can be at least what the average platoon male, you know, could do, you know,
yeah,
for a tour. And, you know, these women were out there for 6 months at a time, you know, going down, you know, dirt roads, you know, checking for, you know, IEDs, no air conditioning, no, you know, bathrooms, anything like that, you know, the same as the guys.
In the thick of it. So what do you think? What does she think? Should the walls come down?
Yes. She thinks that, you know, women should be able, you know, if they can do it, you know, they should be allowed to do it. You know, she might be ahead of the curve. You know, she's the type of woman, she can do, you know, 30 pull-ups. She could probably take the average guy. You have guys like, you know, Rick Santorum and things like that. You know, they're looking at, I think from their perspective, you know, my wife can't do that, so therefore no women can do it. Or my daughter can't do that, so therefore, you know, nobody's daughter can do it.
And what do you think, Jack? And these are your daughters in there. Here's Judy writes us on Facebook. She says, Rick Santorum has no right to judge women's ability to serve on the front lines. But what about he makes the point that, well, men are trained to protect women, and so that, you know, they'll be distracted by that rather than the combat mission itself.
Well, I'd rather have my daughter back me up in a bar situation than Rick Santorum. She could take Rick Santorum. I mean, she would make him tap out so quickly that, you know, I would like to see him, you know, go head to head with some of these women.
Jack, I appreciate your call, and I wish good luck to your daughters and thank them for the service. Robert McGinnis, there's a father who has two daughters in the thick of it, and you hear how he sees it. He'd rather be backed up by his daughter than, let's say, Rick Santorum. But, you know, facetiousness aside, she's got the capacity. She wants to do it. He says, let her defend the country.
Yeah, they're phenomenal women in terms of certainly what I've seen over the years. You know, we have never denied the fact that there are some great young women that are serving well, that have full capacity to do this. The question from a policy perspective is whether or not we want to treat young women as the same, and if there were a future draft, would we put them in the exact same positions as men? And you have to look at that and consider the ramifications. You know, I listed the physical issues. I talked about the sexual issues. You know, when you ask young women, certainly in the armed forces, and we stopped that here in the last few years, but before, and this is documented by the Army Research Council and also by the GAO, they say no. They say they should be allowed to volunteer. However, they should not be forced into those positions. And that's, I think, one of the cruxes of the issue. Will we in the future, because we have forgotten about these reasons why perhaps we should not do this, are we going to then put women in places that are going to not only hurt them, but jeopardize our overall ability to fight? And I'm concerned about that.
Robert McGinnis, I know we have to let you go today, but I very much appreciate your coming on. Thank you for your time and thoughts.
Well, thank you, Tom.
I want to come back to this issue about where this may go down the road, but a couple more calls first, Margaret and Kayla, if I may. Ann is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm the executive director of Alston Wilkes Society. One of the things that we do in South Carolina is we have facilities for formerly homeless veterans. I've been listening to all the conversation. And my father was a World War II vet. You know, women have been serving in capacities and wars that they haven't been getting credit for. for many, many, many years.
Mm.
And I have a former employee who leads 3,000 Army soldiers. I have a fellow Lander alumni, Lander University alumni, who is the Assistant Adjutant General of the National Guard in South Carolina, who is a female. Another caller made reference to, I think it was Robert, about women getting pregnant. I don't want to be facetious, but it takes two people for somebody to get pregnant, and it shouldn't be all landed on the credit given to the woman or the discredit.
So as a woman who sees veterans and who knows something from your family about war, you say take the boundaries down?
Of course. I mean, it's just like anything else. You know, I fought for the ERA. I'm almost 62 years old. And women who were in the homes were angry because they said we wanted everybody to go to work. It was all about equality, just like this is. It's all about if you are a woman, and I could never do what these women do. I know that about me. Therefore, I would never put myself in that position because I physically couldn't do it. But for the women who can and want to, just like the men who can and want to, then they should be given the opportunity. This thing of telling them they can't do something, and it's, by the way, the end result, in my opinion, of all this, it's really about power. It's who has the power. And if the women aren't given the ability to earn all of the awards and badges and courageous things that you can win, then they won't be, have the opportunity to become the generals and the all the, and all of the various
Certainly that's the case that's been made. Anne, I appreciate your call and thoughts very much. And let me get one more, if I may, here. Thank you, Anne. Iowa City, Iowa. Maria, you're on the air, Maria.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a military family. My uncle was had the Silver Star at Iwo Jima. He was a Marine commander. My father was a paratrooper in New Guinea. My grandfather was a colonel in the Army, and my other uncle flew a B-17 in World War II. And I felt really cheated when I took a career aptitude or career interest test at 43 and found out that I should have been an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. I have the personality profile of a field marshal. You know, I can't help being who I am, and that's what I, that's who I am. And yet those opportunities were denied to me. I think women will never have equality until they are considered equal, and there is no front line. Robert McGinnis is wrong. There is no front line in the kinds of wars we fight anymore, and I don't know what about the current wars that we're in would make him think that we are returning to conventional warfare. Obviously, we're engaged in guerrilla warfare, and I think his reactions are regressive, and he's cherry-picking the data that he wants to look at to prove that women shouldn't be in combat. I mean, you can't pick whether women are going to be in combat. The field, the front line is wherever the action is, and you can't predict ahead of time where that action is.
Maria, you sound like a field marshal to me, and I appreciate your call as well. Let me get another right here. Matt, Harrisonburg, Virginia. Matt, you're on the air. Thank you, Maria. Matt, you're on.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Yeah. What's your experience, Matt? What do you know?
Well, I'm in the Marine Corps, and I've spent 2 years, two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And the last caller is wrong. There is a very, very strong front line. Just getting back from Afghanistan this past fall, there are bases that never see combat. And there are some, like I've been, where we spend months and months and months out in the field with no showers. But I think the main question we have to ask here is not should women be in combat, but if they are, we have to up these basic prerequisites. Because right now, especially in the Marine Corps and all services, women have to do lower physical fitness tests, lower combat fitness tests. They can go slower, but when I'm in combat and I go down, I don't weigh any less because she's a female taking me out.
Right.
I'm not saying they shouldn't be allowed, but we need to up these very basic minimum requirements.
You mean if a female colleague had to carry you off the field if you were wounded, for example?
Exactly, yeah. Or hand me ammo cans that weigh 35, 40 pounds, some of them up to 50 or 60 pounds. If we require them to lift less of these for points, for instance, for the basic prerequisites, then we can't allow them in combat. And so they do the basic things that men do in training.
Matt, what about the idea that's been put forward here today that the individuals should be assessed on their own strength, not by their gender, but male and female? If they can do it, go for it. If they can't, don't.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea, but I think that's a big hurdle that a lot of people are going to have to jump, because a lot of people, a lot of women I've met with in combat zones think that since their bodies are built differently than ours, that they should be allotted a slower run time, a lot of less push-ups, a lot of less, not all of them, but a lot of them still have that stigma that we have to overcome.
Right. Margaret and Kaylee, you're very patient. Let me get one more call, then I'll bring it all to you. Peter in Boston. Thank you, Matt, very much, and for your service. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, great show. Listen, one of your more conservative listeners, but kudos for the show. But I also happen to be a combat Marine, different war in Vietnam, and, mm-hmm. and we lost a lot in 1st Marine Division. We lost a lot of our people also with booby traps, but in the rear areas. A lot of people think, if you forget your history, south of Da Nang, we had a lot of booby traps, villages where at nighttime they'd come out and there'd be booby traps.
Yep.
So I think that's first, a lot of where the women casualties, and they do a great job over there, are on these IEDs getting exploded. That's mm-hmm. that's convoy supply.
Yep.
What I think the big issue, right, is like this young other Marine said, is the combat arms, the guys who go into the infantry. Again, those are the minority in the Marine Corps that actually go in the infantry, the
right.
scout sniper, the infantry, is a big physicality that's required. And again, there are some women that can possibly do it, yes, but there's so very few. One of the things, for example, most people don't know, there's two in Marine boot camp. There's women Marine boot camp and men Marines.
Mm-hmm.
The physical strength requirements are much higher in the men Marines. You can't get through boot camp and join your infantry outfits without having gone through it.
But if a woman can do it, if they did the same training and they proved their physical capacity to the same degree, then would you say, all right, Peter, or not?
Well, I would, if a certain one, yeah, if they could, if certain women could do it, the problem what you have is like in a Fallujah or a Helmand. When you go in and you have 50, 75 casualties, you have to go back and pull whoever can do it, can do their job. You need, generally it's men yeah. who have been trained, you know, who have the physicality to then to go in and replace and, with the grunts. The final point is the woman, again, great credit to her, but is a little disingenuous. When the people are assigned as interpreters, they're not leading assaults. They're with the CP group. When an infantry outfit goes out and make an assault in Fallujah, they're back. They're there with everybody. Can they get killed? Sure, because anybody out there can get killed. But the front assaults, the ones who are doing the assaults into the building, those are the grunts. Those who are kicking the door down, those are the guys who are doing the trigger pulling and dying and killing. Those are the that's in the infantry. Those are the warriors who are up there doing it. You have just because you were an interpreter, yes, you go out there and you can. It doesn't necessarily mean you were out there doing the assault. And I had many times with interpreters assigned to us. They came out and sure could they get shot because everybody else was.
Yep.
However, they didn't do the assault.
Peter, we've got it. Our time grows short. Kayla, first, just to that point. I mean, you're very clear about what your role was there. Yes, it put you in the middle of a lot of bullets. Peter's saying, when it comes to the physicality, he still wants somebody who's proven that they can do it, you know, up front, kicking down the door, if that's what's required. You agree?
I've said all along that if there are physical requirements, they should be applied across the board. And right now, the physical requirements for men change as they get older. And if that means that older men can't be in the infantry anymore, then fine, apply that across the board. I completely agree with the previous caller that there are certain requirements and they should be applied universally. I'd also like to very briefly touch on Rick Santorum's point that that men are hardwired to protect women and, mm-hmm. and they might not be able to keep on the mission because of this issue. I find it completely baffling that we reserve our nation's highest honor for men who sacrifice their lives for their male comrades. If you fling yourself on a grenade to save your male comrades,
yep.
you're a hero. But if you were to do the same thing for your female comrades, that would be because they distracted you from the mission.
Hmm.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Margaret, what about Robert McGinnis earlier saying, look, if we go further down this road, if we take all the walls down, you will eventually have conscription and you will have American women conscripted into the front lines of combat who may want nothing to do with that.
Tom, I find that fascinating because I see no direction towards a draft. We're facing a downsized force, so we'll have even less motivation to move to a draft. We have no problem recruiting into our force. Recruiting into a smaller force will be easier.
But somewhere down the road that could change. I mean, we all know that ebbs and flows over time.
It does ebb and flow, but we see at this point no direction towards a draft. And another point that he made about women's attitudes towards being forced into combat, treated like men, there's actually very robust data that shows that Female officers, female NCOs, those that have committed to the military believe strongly that they should be treated just like their male peers, that they should be assigned to occupations just as their male peers are, to include combat.
Should there be any acknowledgement of the cultural history of not putting women in combat roles? Let's say there were a draft again. Would you be in favor of having them drafted to combat roles or not?
I would be in favor of having female service members treated just as their male service members as long as they were physically qualified to do the job.
We're in a situation today where fewer and fewer of our young people qualify for military service at all due to being so physically unfit, unfortunately, because of the obesity epidemic. And to make any additional requirements that keep women out of roles if they are physically fit enough seems to be a ridiculous way to limit the access of the military to the most qualified. I'd also like to add that in a survey at the Army War College in 2006, 74% of these mid-career Army officers believe that all troops should be allowed to serve for positions for which they are qualified, regardless of gender. Well, that's where we're going.
This is going to be very interesting to watch in the years ahead. I wonder what will happen with withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan if this trend stops in its tracks or just keeps going. Kayla Williams, you speak very clearly and out of some experience there as an interpreter in Iraq, as a sergeant, and we appreciate your being with us today, Kayla. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Harrell with the Center for New American Security. Thanks very much for being with us, Margaret.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks to all of our listeners and callers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.